You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archive materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. Today's case was researched in collaboration with our podcasting friends from True Crime Investigators UK. John and Sally are retired law enforcement officers who use their investigative experience to bring you a top-notch podcast. If you'd like to hear interviews with pivotal people mentioned in this case, as well as John and Sally's valuable input, make sure to listen to their episode. You can find the link to True Crime Investigators UK in the show notes. On Saturday, September 3rd, 1983, a passing motorist went into the woods at Telegraph Hill, Exeter, to relieve himself when he saw something curious in the undergrowth. The man, a local plumber called Colin Marshall, was intrigued by the object. At first, he thought it was a soggy mattress, but as he walked closer, he noticed a discolored human foot. This was no mattress, but a headless human body. Colin rushed back to his car and drove to the nearest phone to call 999. When police arrived, they uncovered the grisly scene of a decapitated female body riddled with bullet wounds. It was clear that she had been dead for some time. The first forensic investigator said that she was probably killed at least 16 days prior. The investigation would lead police to uncover dark secrets within one of Britain's wealthiest families. This is a scandal that rocked the upper class to its very core. Michael Henry Maxwell Telling, the only child of Joyce and Maxwell Telling, was born on the 17th of May, 1950. Maxwell, who used to be an Air Force pilot, was a violent drunk. So when the marriage collapsed, it was no surprise. After only 4 years, with Michael only 3 years old, Joyce and Maxwell went their separate ways. Joyce was financially secure and could easily walk away. In fact, she hailed from the Vesty family, believed to be the second wealthiest in all of Britain, that is, after the Queen. The Vesties started the iconic butcher franchise, Davurst. In the early 20th century, most high streets in the UK had one. The Vestie brothers also pioneered cold storage food shipping, which enabled them to dominate the market of international meat import and export. When Joyce's grandfather, William Vestie, saw the waste at a meat plant in Chicago, he and his brother Edmund devised a way of preserving it. Canned beef became a popular wartime essential, and the Vesties saw their fortune grow. Despite having all the money in the world, young Michael Telling had a very lonely and unhappy childhood. His alcoholic father was hot-tempered, and his mother was disengaged. His parents had their own lives, and there was not much love to spare for their awkward little boy. At the young age of 6, Michael showed the first signs of antisocial behavior when he started a fire at his exclusive boarding school. When he was 9, he set another fire, this time destroying a staircase inside the school building. There were also reports of him skipping class, stealing money from his friends, and vandalizing property. He even ran around naked in the schoolyard on one occasion. Michael had become such a problem, his family name, and the fortune that came with it, was not enough to keep him at school, and he was expelled. When he went home from boarding school, he was confined to a wing of the family mansion, away from the rest of the family. Michael had his own nannies, and hardly had contact with his mother. During one summer vacation, he caused havoc. He bit his aunt's hand, and on another occasion, attacked his own mother with a carving knife, which he kept in his room. And all of this happened before his 10th birthday. After being expelled from a second boarding school, Joyce Vesti agreed that her son should be admitted to Maudsley Psychiatric Hospital in South London. In his late teens, it became evident that he was a fantasist and a liar. He romanticized his life, claiming to be a spy. He fancied himself to be a James Bond-like character who traveled the world in luxury, drove fast cars and motorbikes, and lived on the edge. However, behind the facade was an insecure man-child who never felt loved. If he made friends, he was always suspicious that they were only around because he had money. In 1966, Michael's mother married surgeon Thomas Strong. Joyce and 16-year-old Michael moved to Australia with his new stepfather to set up home in the exclusive Sydney Harbourside suburb, Kirribilli, a stone's throw away from the Prime Minister's residence. 4 years later, when Michael was 20, he moved to the other side of the country and settled in Perth. At the time, he was doing odd jobs, but never committed to anything, as he knew he'd be able to live comfortably, thanks to his family's wealth. His mother Joyce's family had strong business ties to Australia, as they had in most countries at the time. Before selling five of their seven cattle farms in 1984, the Vesti family was the largest private landowner in the whole of Australia. During the First World War, they purchased 6 million acres of land across the country. By 1925, Vesti Holdings had more than 450,000 cattle on ranches in the land down under. But the 1966 protest at Wave Hill caused irreparable damage to their image. 200 Aboriginal workers walked off Vesti-owned land in protest, stating that they were only paid a quarter of what their European counterparts earned. The Gurindji people petitioned the government, and the dispute carried on over the next decade. Eventually, Lord Vesti offered to surrender 90 square kilometers back to the Gurindji people. So when Michael Telling arrived in Perth in 1970, the Vesti name wouldn't necessarily be something to be too proud of. And in a country of migrants, people typically didn't ask too many questions about his background. Telling's closest friends probably knew who he was. He was not actively involved in the day-to-day business of Vesti Holdings, so to people he didn't know that well, he played down the extent of his wealth and simply said he was an importer-exporter. It was in Perth where Michael Telling met British-born waitress Alison Ruth Weber in 1976. 2 years later, they married and relocated to England. The Vesti Trust bought them a house in the seaside town of Torquay, Devon. After they settled in March 1979, Michael and Alison's son, Matthew James Maxwell Telling, was born. Michael struggled sharing his wife's attention with their baby, and their marriage became strained. Michael pulled away and preferred to pursue his own hobbies. One of his interests took him to the California Bay Area in the fall of 1980. Michael went to San Francisco with the sole purpose of buying himself a new, special edition Harley-Davidson. On one of his first motorbike runs with his new bike, he met the Zumsteg family. Lou, Elsa, and their 18-year-old daughter, Erica, were out for a bike ride of their own in Sausalito when Michael pulled up next to them at a traffic light. It was hard not to notice his limited edition, dual-belt drive Harley-Davidson Sturgis, and the Zumstegs struck up a conversation with him. Lou invited Michael to visit them at their home in Santa Rosa, and Michael, with a keen eye on Erica, gladly accepted the invitation. He was quite open about his intentions with Erica, and she felt he came on a bit strong, especially when he gave her an opal necklace. Erica made it clear that she didn't have romantic feelings for him, but she liked him and wanted to be friends. As such, Michael backed off, but for the following week, he still spent a lot of time at the Zumsteg residence. He came to know the family quite well. Lou was married to Swiss national Elsa, and they had 3 children. Monica was the eldest by 6 years, and 18-year-old Erica had a twin brother, Mark. When Michael Telling met the family, Erica and Mark still lived at home, and Monica, a career-driven young woman, was living by herself. Michael stayed with the Zumstegs for a bit, and they suggested he went to Sacramento to meet Monica. The instant they met, sparks flew. Monica, closer in age to Michael than Erica, was evidently a better match than her sister. And it looked like Michael's feelings were reciprocated. Monica fell for him pretty quickly. Monica held a degree in journalism from the College of San Mateo and also studied industrial studies and business at Holy Names College in Belmont. When she met Michael, she was working at an IT firm. She had recently been promoted and was taking a new position in Burbank, Los Angeles. Michael Telling had a lot of knowledge of firearms and told Lou that he owned many guns. When Lou asked him why, he confided in him and Monica. He said that he worked for British intelligence and could not go into much detail about his job. Monica was intrigued by this quiet, well-mannered, international man of mystery on a motorcycle. He was refined and charming, but there was something unsettling about him at the same time. Monica found it rather exciting and threw herself fully into the relationship. It was a whirlwind romance, and Michael did not want to leave America without Monica. He impressed her father, Lou, by visiting Monica's family home in Santa Rosa to ask for her hand in marriage before he proposed to her. He assured the Zumstegs that he was in a good position to provide for Monica and that she would never have to worry about money. This is when Michael revealed the fact that he did not actually have a job. However, he had a monthly income of about £30,000, which covered credit cards, homes, cars, and other bills. All of this was provided to him by the Vestige Trust. Michael had the means to do whatever he pleased, and he was all too happy to share his fortune with the beautiful Monica. Monica was surprised when she learned that her husband-to-be came from one of the wealthiest families in England. She had fallen for him without knowing the good financial fortune she had stepped into. Perhaps, blinded by the gold, she forgave him for lying about being a spy. She put it down to the possibility that he just wanted to impress her. Michael also explained that he wanted to make sure she loved him for who he was and not for his money. That is why he did not tell her from the start. He did not tell her that he was a married father, however. Michael Telling was eager to marry his Californian beauty, but had to end his marriage to Allison first. He returned to England to tell her he had met someone else. Allison was dumbfounded, but realized he had made up his mind. They decided to travel to Sydney together to inform his mother about their divorce. But once they were at the airport, Michael got in a plane to Los Angeles instead. He needed to see Monica. In the months that followed, he pushed for his divorce from Allison to be finalized as soon as possible. The initial wedding date had to be moved while proceedings were being wrapped up in England. While Monica waited, Michael put her up in a luxurious apartment in Los Angeles. Only when Monica went to England did she learn about Michael's wife and son. She called her family and was very upset that he never told her about them. The wedding day came in November 1981, 7 months after they first met. It was a small, civil ceremony in Wickham, England, with only a handful of guests. Their honeymoon kicked off at a hotel in Hyde Park, London, followed by multiple overseas trips to Austria, Morocco, and Australia. The plan was always for Michael and Monica to live in Michael's native England after the wedding. They rented a place in Royal Tunbridge Wells before they found the perfect home in Buckinghamshire, a sprawling estate on Radnage Lane, High Wycombe, called Lamburn House. Their house was a lavishly renovated stone barn with only the best trimmings and multiple garages to house all of Michael's cars. Michael and Monica lapped up their life of luxury, all of it courtesy of the Vestie Trust. Monica embraced her new lifestyle in High Wycombe, west from London, and learned to ride, joined neighbors for fox hunts, and entertained guests at their home. Friends envied the Tellings. They seemed to have everything anyone could ever dream of: fast cars, exotic travels, and splendid parties. As a hobby, Monica collected and sold antiques at a local market. From time to time, she posed as a model, as she had done in her early 20s in California. But her life as an educated, independent working woman was a distant memory. She lived in a gilded cage and was always looking for something to do. One of her friends said that Monica was wealthy, lovely, and bored. Also, behind closed doors, things between Michael and Monica were not all that rosy and sweet. One night, police were called to Lamburn House because of a domestic dispute. The officer said that 26-year-old Monica was polite but visibly shaken. An aggressive Michael reportedly drew his firearm on the responding officer. He was charged with firearm offenses and fined £10,000. The Vestie Trust Fund paid the fine, yet again bailing out the 33-year-old Michael, who did not feel the consequences of his actions. In 1983, the Tellings had been married for a year and a half. Monica's family knew her life with Michael was no walk in the park. They pleaded with her to return to California, but she insisted that she wanted to help her husband. It was around March or April that Monica fell out of contact with her family. They felt they had pushed too hard for her to leave Michael and gave her some space. But when she still had not been in touch after 5 months, they grew concerned. Meanwhile, back in Buckinghamshire, Monica's friends heard that she had walked out on Michael. She had left suddenly, and Michael told friends and neighbors that things between them didn't work out, and that she had gone back to America. Michael, furious that his wife had left him, hired a private investigator to track her down. Bank records showed that she was still using her ATM card all around England. But the investigator had no luck in locating her whereabouts. On Saturday, the 3rd of September 1983, police were called to the woods at Halden Hills, Devon. Local plumber Colin Marshall had stumbled across the headless body of a female shooting victim. The body was badly decomposed, and they were not able to identify the victim. Investigators went to the media and distributed a photo of her clothing, hoping someone, somewhere, would be able to help. The public appeal resulted in no less than 107 suggestions for persons fitting the description of the deceased. One of those was a woman from West Wickham, Buckinghamshire, 180 miles away from where the body was found. She was friends with Monica Zumsteg Telling and had recognized the picture when she saw it in the newspaper. It was a recognizable beige t-shirt with the picture of a camel and the words, "Souvenir of Morocco," written in Arabic. The friend told police that she had not seen Monica for several months when she left her husband in early spring. The pink shorts worn by the victim could be traced to a shop in San Francisco. So when investigators learned about Monica's background, they decided it was time to pay a visit to her marital home. A week after her body was discovered, police searched Lamburn House and made a ghastly discovery. One of Michael Telling's favorite cars, a Mini Cooper, was parked inside the garage. When police opened the trunk, they found Monica's head in a plastic bag. When confronted with the evidence, Telling had to admit that he had been driving around with his wife's severed head in his car for a week. He admitted that he shot her with his .30-30 hunting rifle on the morning of the 29th of March. When police asked him why, he reportedly said there were 101 reasons for killing his wife. But on that particular morning, the couple had an argument in the sitting room of their home. Michael claimed that he threatened to shoot Monica. He said, "She kept taunting me. She came charging towards me. I thought she was going to attack me, so I picked up the rifle and shot her." The shot struck Monica twice, once in the chest and once in the neck, killing her instantly. Michael Telling did not know what to do. In a state of panic and denial, he kept her body in the house for a week, moving her from room to room. In his recount to police, he painted a macabre picture of himself who sat by his dead wife's side, talked to her, and kissed her before he left the room. After a week, he decided to move her to an outbuilding, into a partly built sauna, where she remained for 5 months. At the beginning of September, he told his friends and neighbors he was going on a camping trip. He rented a van, loaded Monica's remains, and drove 3 hours to Devon, a county he knew well because he had lived there with his first wife, Allison. Initially, Michael planned to bury Monica's body in a cemetery, but could not find a suitable spot. In the end, he settled on a location near Telegraph Hill, Exeter. At the secluded wooded location, a lover's lane of sorts, he chopped off her head with an axe and wrapped it up in a plastic bag. He left her body and returned to Lamburn House, where he placed the head in the trunk of his Mini Cooper. Telling claimed that he took Monica's head off, in part so it would complicate identification, but ultimately, he did not want to leave all of her. He told police, "I always loved Monica. Even after she had died, I wanted her to be with me." Psychologist Robert Blueglass later testified that he believed this is actually why he kept her head, because he wanted to take some part of her back with him. Monica's family was informed of her murder by Exeter police on Sunday morning, the 11th of September. They could not believe it. They knew things were not going too well between their daughter and her husband, but never in their wildest dreams would they have thought Michael Telling was capable of killing Monica. Monica's sister Erica was not surprised. 5 months before, she had a sudden moment of angst. She was scared and angry all at the same time. To this day, Erica believes that that moment was the moment her sister died, and that she had sensed it. It is rumored that while on remand in Exeter, Telling was not the average prisoner. An anonymous person who claimed to have been a fellow inmate posted on an online forum years later that Telling had catered meals delivered to his prison cell. He shared his steak, oysters, and other fine foods with everyone to win their favor. Michael Telling's first court appearance came on September 12, 1983, at Winsford Magistrates Court, Exeter. His trial was scheduled for June the following year, and eventually lasted 9 days. Telling had the best legal representation money could buy. Barrister George Carman, a charismatic legal personality, approached the case with confidence and flair. Newspapers all over the UK gave the trial extensive coverage. The horrific story also made waves in America and Australia. Reports of the headless corpse trial were everywhere. As details emerged inside the courtroom, people watched in awe. 33-year-old Linda Blackstock, a neighbor who had met Michael Telling over the local CB radio, said that she had a 4-week affair with Telling after Monica's murder. During that time, he attempted sexual intercourse with her more than once, but never managed to do so. She said, "I think he felt humiliated. He tried more than once, but we never had sex fully." According to Linda, Michael told her his wife had left him. In their conversations about his wife, Linda assumed that Monica was still alive. Meanwhile, the spot where he tried to make love to Linda was right next to the sauna where he had hidden Monica's body. Meanwhile, the room where he tried to make love to Linda was right next to the sauna where he had hidden Monica's body. By this time, Michael had installed an electric air freshener and sealed the sauna off, so the smell of Monica's decomposing body was contained. Linda ended things between them when Michael overplayed his hand. As he did with Monica, he tried to convince Linda that he worked for Britain's Special Air Service, SAS, and said that his job had something to do with the special branch. He alluded to his time in the Falklands in special operations, and when his own lies tripped him up, she broke off their relationship. While Monica's body was wasting away in the sauna that summer, Michael's ex-wife Allison, who worked as a flight instructor by this time, came to visit so he could see their son. Allison and Matthew also came for a brief visit in September after Telling had disposed of Monica's body. During that visit, Michael gave Allison Monica's Rolex and some jewelry. Allison refused to take it, but Michael assured her that Monica had left him and that she wasn't coming back. He did ask Allison for a favor, though. He requested she send him the front page of her local newspaper when she returned to Devon. This was clearly an attempt to keep an eye on the news to see if anyone had discovered Monica's body. Telling's defense revealed what was going on inside the marriage from Michael's perspective. He claimed that Monica, a heavy drinker, taunted him with affairs with other men and women. She berated his competency in the bedroom and made it clear that she had only married him for his money. The defense painted a picture of a bohemian life together with drugs, parties, and bisexual dalliances. Telling recalled an incident before they were married. He allegedly walked into their living room and found Monica making love to the neighbor's wife. Telling also claimed that Monica was too drunk on their wedding night to consummate the marriage. She also denied him sex for the last 7 months of her life, and on the morning he shot her, he just snapped. Richard Richardson, a neighbor of the Tellings, confirmed in his testimony that Monica was bisexual and that all she ever wanted from Michael was money. Richardson felt Michael was terrified of his wife, who belittled him and reveled in her promiscuity. Other witnesses also came forward with similar stories. They claimed that Michael was made to watch his wife make love to other men and women right in his own house. One witness recalled Monica revealing that she had reconnected with a former boyfriend during a trip to America. Another story was that Monica even taught their pet cockatoo to say, "Piss off, Michael." Everyone said that Michael never reacted to her taunts. He only looked on, passively. Richard Richardson went so far as to say, "I wanted to take Michael into the garden and knock some sense into him and tell him not to take it. He used to lift her hand up and kiss it and kiss the top of her head. That used to rile me." Expert psychologists testified that the constant taunting would have been deeply humiliating for someone like Michael Telling, who was still rather childlike. He was insecure in himself and sexually, and having his wife make a mockery of his innermost vulnerability distressed him to a large extent. Most of the witnesses were neighbors from High Wycombe, who had a conservative view of how one should behave. They were of the opinion that Monica had brought her unconventional Californian habits into their world. Everyone felt that she was already a heavy drinker by the time she moved into Lambren House, and that swinging came naturally to her. A gay couple came forward and claimed that they had an ongoing relationship with Monica. Karen Mayers and her girlfriend Julie Chamberlain met Monica at the pizzeria where Karen worked. Karen and Monica became friends, who shared the occasional joint. Their friendship soon developed into something more, and most of their trysts happened at the Telling home. Another witness, home decorator Joe Stennings, also claimed to have had a sexual relationship with Monica. He said he would visit Monica at her house if she did not seem to worry about being caught. He recalled a conversation in which Monica allegedly said, "When Michael blows my head off one day, you'll be able to tell it to the newspapers." However, no one who knew Monica in California believed these allegations to be true. If anything, Monica was reserved and polite. She was focused on her career and was close to her family. None of her friends or family members ever knew Monica to have taken drugs or to have been bisexual. During the trial, Lou Zumsteg lashed out about the way the defense portrayed his daughter, calling the claims of her taunting sexual habits untrue smears. Because prosecution's job is to only state the facts of the crime, they felt that no one was defending Monica and her character. Her family described a relationship with Michael Telling to the press. They said it was like a fairy tale romance at first, but soon the cracks began to show. Michael was volatile, and his moods were unpredictable. On more than one occasion, he flew into a jealous rage, wrecking their furniture and threatening violence. He was a diabetic and would use his illness to gain sympathy from his wife. When she threatened to leave him, he'd send himself into an insulin shock. Monica, ready to walk out on him, uncovered details about her husband's past. She learned that he had had mental health issues and told her family she wanted to stay and help him through it. His family did not want a scandal surrounding a mentally unstable heir, so most of his actions were swept under the rug. Because of the fact that she was left alone to deal with the unstable Michael, Monica turned to alcohol. A clerk who worked at a removal company in London said that Monica called on the 14th of March to inquire about moving some personal items to California. She asked him not to send a written note to Lambren House, as she wanted to keep her plans confidential. According to the clerk, Monica hinted at the fact that she had had enough of England and that her marriage was disappointing. She reportedly also told neighbor Richard Richardson about her plans and said that she was going to ask for a £50,000 settlement from her husband. 2 weeks later, Monica was dead. One of three psychiatrists who was called as an expert witness, medical director at Broadmoor, Dr. John Hamilton, said that he did not think the killing was an impulsive one. Dr. Hamilton had interviewed Telling while he was on remand in Exeter on several occasions. According to Dr. Hamilton, Telling said that he had decided to kill Monica while the couple stayed at the Hyde Park Hotel, a trip to try and save their marriage. When things did not go well, Telling decided there and then that he would kill her. He did not know how, but he knew he would. In March, Monica had a short stint in hospital following dental surgery. When she arrived home at Lambren House, Telling decided that he would shoot her the following day. In court, Dr. Hamilton said, If it had been an impulsive, heat-of-the-moment action, the firing of the first shot might well have brought him to his senses, as it were. But this cocking of the rifle twice, and the firing of three shots again, underlines to me the cold-blooded, calculated way in which he killed her. Dr. Hamilton also pointed out that Telling went through great trouble to cover up his crime. He cleaned the carpet in the sitting room, then had an electric air freshener installed in the sauna before he moved her body there. He was the one who used Monica's ATM card and then hired the PI to look for his missing wife, all the while knowing exactly where she was. On June 29, 1984, after 2 hours of deliberation, Michael Telling was found guilty of manslaughter and sentenced to life in prison. But he was not found guilty of murder due to diminished responsibility. Solicitor Max Lowe Tomlinson explained to international media that diminished responsibility meant Telling's mind was substantially disordered at the time of the killing. It could also be considered the same thing as temporary insanity. The press took pity on Michael, the man who never grew up, whose own mother spoke openly about his childhood challenges in court. The jury agreed with the defense that he had suffered from mental impairment at the time of the murder. This is what Telling told his barrister. He said, "I am so pleased for my son's sake that I am not branded a murderer." The tabloids loved this story. It had all the elements: a member of the aristocracy and his beautiful American wife embroiled in a scandal involving sex, drugs, and ultimately, murder. An article in the London Standard was captioned, "Not evil, but mad." Another headline read, "I loved her, but I shot her." Monica's body was returned to Santa Rosa, where her family laid her to rest at Calvary Cemetery in December 1983. Monica's father said he felt half crazy after what was said about his daughter during the trial. He was guilt-ridden about the fact that he was the one who had introduced Monica to her killer back in Santa Rosa. Lou Zumsteg said, "Michael inspires me both with anger and compassion. Obviously, you need a lot of help from psychiatrists. When I think of him, I can't forget that nice young man who asked me for my daughter's hand. But sometimes, I wake up at night and wonder, how, my God, could I have allowed such a thing to happen?" Michael Telling served 11 years in prison and was released in January 1994. He had decided to go back to the most isolated city on the planet, Perth. It was evident that he had planned his next chapter while still in prison. Because of his extended stay in Australia between 1966 and 1981, it is fair to assume he had dual citizenship. Therefore, he would not have to apply for a visa and disclose his crime. He could enter Australia and restart his life on a clean page. No questions asked. While he was in prison, his wealth accumulated, and he was granted the privileges of the Vestey Trust once he was free. Within 3 months of his release, the 44-year-old heir was living in Perth and bought a house for $750,000 in Rosmoyne. He soon purchased a neighboring home as well for $300,000. Telling could easily blend in with the understated wealthy socialites of Perth without ever disclosing too much about his past. Rosmoyne is a desirable riverside suburb, good for families with big blocks of land. This is also good for someone who would not like to be too close to their neighbors. Telling was somewhat of a recluse and kept to himself. People who knew him in Perth described Telling as an English gentleman. He continued fueling his passion for motor vehicles and was an active member of the Jaguar Club. He was also a cricket enthusiast and held a Western Australian Cricket Association, or WACA, membership. He enjoyed watching matches, and everything about him seemed cool, calm, and collected. And he always ate alone. Michael Telling died on the 16th of December, 2009, at hospice because of complications due to diabetes at the age of 59. Only when he died did Paul Murray, editor of the West Australian, receive a tip about Telling's past. It was one of Paul's readers who had informed him. The expose article in the West Australian was titled, "Killer Secret Life in Perth." Jaguar dealer Wilf Chambers was Telling's best friend in Perth and said he knew Michael was an aristocrat but would never have guessed that he had killed his wife. When he died, none of his close friends knew anything about his murder conviction back in England. On his death certificate, His ex-wife Allison and his son Matthew were noted, but there was no mention of his second marriage. He clearly never told anyone in Perth that he was married to Monica, let alone that he murdered her and had served time for it. To his friends and neighbors, this killer was nothing more than an unassuming man. But then again, killers often are simply the person next door, hiding in plain sight. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. If you like our podcast, please subscribe on Apple Podcast or wherever you are listening right now. And while you're waiting for our next episode, why not listen to one of our podcasting friends?
Hi, we are True Crime Investigators UK. I'm John.
And I'm Sally. We research and review serious crime cases from the United Kingdom. We bring our professional experience to our listeners. We've spent all of our working lives in law enforcement.
We invite you to listen to our discussions and our interviews with suspects, victims and their families, police officers and experts. We put our feet on the street where these crimes happened.
We aren't scripted and we don't sensationalise. We give you the facts. There's more information on our website, truecrimeinvestigators.co.uk.
This is The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.